thank you all for being here today to celebrate Kash Patel.
First and foremost, we were just with President Trump. What a ride we have been on. Faith and trust he's put in me to lead the FBI is the greatest honor that I'll ever have in my life. I am living the American dream. We will uphold the Constitution. We will uphold ourselves to the Constitution. The men and women at the FBI, I have your back because you have the backs of the American people.
Sandy Rios with you on Sandy Rios 24/7, the voice of Kash Patel, who is now the new FBI Director of the United States. It's a pretty amazing thing, but I think the whole issue at the FBI is so complex. We're talking about rebellion at the FBI. We're talking about them scrubbing files, resisting Pam Bondi. They're going to resist Kash Patel. We talk about the deception, the groundwork that was laid by prior directors like Comey and Ray. There is so much to a discussion, and we're going to get into that today with whistleblower Steve Friend, former FBI agent. And he's been with us before. You'll recognize him, but he's very knowledgeable, and we're going to get into the nuts and bolts and the inner workings of what's happening in the FBI right now. As long as the abortion pill is legally mailed and taken in all 50 states, no state can be abortion-free. Abortion pills carry distinct risks to mothers and death to babies, and now accounts for over 60% of all abortions. Preborn's network of clinics shine a light into this darkness by offering free services to women considering the future of their baby, including the abortion reversal pill. This powerful remedy can help reverse the curse of this toxic medication. Preborn reaches into the heart of babies and mothers and with God's love and compassion. And to date, they have rescued over 300,000 babies. Your tax-deductible monthly support of any amount is crucial in the fight for life. All proceeds go toward life, and together we can reverse this horrible curse. Saving babies isn't just about one life. It's about saving the heartbeat of the entire nation. To donate, please go to preborn.com/Sandy. That's preborn.com/Sandy. Well, this is Sandy Rios 24/7. You can listen to us on any podcast platform. You can email us. And by the way, we're going to be doing an email show pretty soon here at sandy@afr.net. Love hearing what you have to say. And I share as many of your email as I can on the air. You can also call us at 662-821-2040. That's 662-821-2040. You can find us on social media platforms, and you can also go to sandyrios.com, listen to the show, and find out more about what we're doing. This is a very interesting conversation with Steve Friend, and I know you're going to enjoy it, and you're going to be benefited by it because it affects all of us. What is the future of the Federal Bureau of Investigation is for the sake of this country and of our safety is important. We'll discuss it on today's edition of Sandy Rios 24/7.
From American Family Radio, Sandy Rios.
We are not called to be nice. We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
I think the most important thing we need to demonstrate to our children is genuineness, that we actually believe what we say we believe.
A longtime Fox News contributor, Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
Seek justice, not social justice, but God's justice, what's right and what's wrong.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association,
a pro-life radio talk show host.
We've got to say this is the line. Life is sacred.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
Is Kash Patel's FBI opening an investigation into James Comey? The Times reports that Comey launched an off-the-books honeypot operation against candidate Donald Trump. According to a whistleblower, he sent two female undercovers to infiltrate Trump's 2016 campaign and told them to act as honeypots, spies who use sex to get what they want. And the honeypots ingratiated themselves into the top ranks of the campaign. If true, that means the Obama administration was conducting multiple phony investigations into Trump without any evidence. The whistleblower says FBI employees were told to shut their mouth about the operation, and one of the agents was transferred to the CIA so she couldn't testify. This investigation into Comey isn't about revenge. It's about justice.
All right, that was Jesse Waters of Fox News, and that's one of the latest scandals, although there's later scandals involving the FBI, which is a very sad thing for the country. Think of all the crimes that have not been solved, all of the dangers we've had on our streets while the FBI has been playing these nefarious games, using as a political arm, really, of the Democratic Party. Well, no one knows that better than my next guest. Steve Friend wrote a book a couple of years ago. I think it's been a couple of years, and we talked at that time. It's called True Blue, My Journey from Beat Cop to Suspended FBI Whistleblower. You might recall that Steve was working on violent crime, human trafficking, and child predators. And then he was reassigned to, hunting J6ers. And he resisted. He saw the FBI doing things that he didn't feel were right. And he actually went through the whistleblower statute and tried to bring it to someone's attention. I'm supposing, we'll ask him, it was for a change. There needs to be a change. This is not right. Trump supporters are not domestic terrorists and all the rest. Things that we know. It's been kind of like stuff of our language for the past, I don't know, how many years has it been? 8? I'm not sure. But Steve's life was changed because he ended up getting suspended. He had 2 little children, and he was not able to work for the FBI anymore. So with that, Steve, I want to say good morning. Is it hard for you? Is it hard for you to be identified as, Steve Friend, FBI whistleblower, than it was to be identified as Steve Friend, special agent for the Federal Bureau of Investigation? Which would you choose?
Well, I mean, I think as long as you were standing on your oath of office, then recovering FBI agent is probably the most appropriate one for me at this point, in light of the fact that the FBI seems to be completely off the rails in the last few years. It's definitely been an adjustment. I mean, we're talking, it's been over 29 months since I walked out the door. And hopefully we're going to see some changes here in the very immediate future with the new director at the helm.
Well, if we can do all of these things I want to do, it'll be a miracle. But I certainly want us to get to that. I do want to ask you personally what you're doing now. I mean, have you found a good position? Because you do have 2 children still, and they're still small. Have you been able to find something, Steve?
No, unfortunately, I seem to be unemployed and unemployable at the moment. We're getting along all right, but it's definitely been a stressor. I've had the opportunity to speak to people like yourself in the media. I'm doing a podcast, which is sort of like a content creator fantasy camp. It's not really a prominent program that's getting a huge audience, but it's definitely been good because I do that with another FBI whistleblower. And now just traveling around whenever I can. But for the most part, it's sort of just at home, almost like home confinement.
Are they yet inviting former agents to come back and rejoin to clean this thing up? And would you do that if they ask you?
Well, from my understanding, there are some people that were brought in very early on in an advisory role. I don't know if they're in the positions of executive leadership now. I'm not in the inner circle there. And then that ultimately comes down to a question of, what sort of input would they like me to have? If the offer were on the table to come in and be part of a solution, I think that's, I'm not really jumping out of my seat to go and then live and work in the swamp, but it's almost like an Isaiah 6:8, who shall I send? Here I am. It's available for tasking to do that. If they wanted me to go back to where I was, which was basically in my town here in Daytona, I'd be working for the same boss who walked me out the office. Which might create a little bit of a conflict here. So it's a difficult situation in light of the last 2.5 years here. I don't know how we resolve it. I'm just hoping that we get to there needs to be a bookend to this story. We got to close the loop one way or another.
Yeah. Well, there has to be. It's not like no one should be hung. I'm not advising that, but it has to be like a Nuremberg trial where the truth is told and there's some kind of punishment for people and a line drawn. And a line drawn, and the FBI not continuing to pretend like what they have done is constitutional and not really actually breaking the law. But I'd be curious to know, my husband's a retired agent, so he knows some things, but you still have people in the bureau. So are you able to describe for us the level of resistance within the FBI? Like the active resistance to Kash Patel and this new change? And soon Dan Bongino?
Yeah, absolutely. There's been subterfuge that's been afoot even since the election in November that they were really laying the groundwork for. I mean, the FBI was promoting people the week before the president was inaugurated, trying to get people, as many people as possible, into positions of high prominence, executive leadership, so they could try to subvert the changes that were coming in. So, you know, another whistleblower, Garrett O'Boyle, brought out the fact that they were shredding documents recently. And we saw last week the resistance from the New York field office to handing over the Epstein list so they could be made public. And I don't know who's defending the Epstein list. I mean, that seems not even like an 80-20 list issue. It's like a 99-1. And then, you know, personally here, I've talked to people on the inside, and really there's a large amount of pushback and landmines being planted with the ICE raids that that the FBI has been tasked with assisting on. So they're having open conversations in the office. They're giving people the opportunity to morally object to deporting members of Tren de Aragua, and then they're allowing them to say what their feelings are on that. And they're calling individuals who are willing to actually follow a lawful, ethical, constitutional, moral order from the president as Nazis, and really get the scarlet letter on them. And then, you know, secondly to that, you know, there's also the bureaucratic avenue to it. So the FBI has created a quota for itself to enrich personnel off the backs of these raids. We're trying to get rid of these vile, vicious gang members. And you have senior executives who are now, if they show up, they have a quota for participation, and then they can get a bonus for that. Or they'll open up terrorist cases that are fake and say that, look, we boosted the number of national security cases we're involved in, really, and it's just they're aiding and assisting ICE in deporting illegal aliens.
You're using present tense. You reported that in present tense. So this is happening as we speak. This has not been stopped.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the special agent in charge of the Omaha field office last week was putting out on his LinkedIn profile how he was standing by at an ICE deportation operation. And there's a reason he's there. That the special agent in charge does not show up to search warrants or arrest operations typically. But the temptation there to personally enrich yourself exists. And there's not a lot of operational security amongst the senior executives in the FBI, because they're really focusing on their future career prospects. So LinkedIn is a pretty rich, target-rich environment for this sort of thing getting put out there. And I noticed that. Try to put that on social media. Hopefully people catch on to that.
Well, all right, so that's a huge amount of resistance. And I just figured, you know, D.C. was our home for a long time. So we've been in that. I've been in the building. Bruce, of course, worked there at headquarters. So we kind of imagine Kash Patel marching into that horrible prison-like building half a dozen people. How in the world does he go in there and try to turn that around with a handful of people? How should that be happening, Steve? What would be the template?
You have to embrace this grip it and rip it strategy. You can't be using a scalpel. There has to be a reimagining of how the organization should probably be run. I mean, you look at the organizational chart, and there's six branches. What are they really doing here? There can be a lot that can be cut, a lot to be consolidated, and that doesn't necessitate as many people. He already vocalized that they're going to move at least 1,500 people out of the Hoover Building, which is very much like in keeping with what Louis Freeh did in the 90s when he was made the FBI director. I mean, just getting rid of intelligence branch entirely, with so much of bureaucracy has been built up into that, and we've turned the FBI from law enforcement into intelligence gathering, but with the ability, with the force of law and a gun and a badge to arrest, and that's the things of secret police. So I think reimagining how the agency should operate is paramount, and he can completely do that as long as he has a small circle of people who just are willing to sit in the room and not do what so many executives have done for decades in the FBI, and that is not be willing to say no to a bad idea.
Yeah. Well, let me expand on what you just said just so people will understand. I met Bruce actually in 2001. We'd both just come to D.C. It was right after 9/11, and it was under Robert Mueller, as you know, that the FBI was transformed from a law enforcement, you know, bank robbers, kidnappings, gangs, transnational gangs, all of that. It was switched. That was the mission, and child trafficking, as you well know, they're suddenly, they have to know, you know, all the Islamic names and investigate all these terrorist organizations when they weren't equipped to do that. There was a handful of agents. It was like a division of the Bureau that understood that. And so I'm going to jump to a different question. How in the world, Steve, do we quantify what hasn't been done? What hasn't been done in terms of keeping America safe since 2001, when really all the resources first went to fighting the terrorists, and then secondly, then went all, it seems to me, most of it, towards arresting so-called domestic terrorists and going after J6ers. How much crime, I mean, would you say has just been ignored in this country?
That's an excellent question, because if you look at what the FBI brags about with its press releases, if that's anything in criminal in nature, by and large, they are local departments, state officials who have made an arrest, and the FBI adopts the case and then takes credit for it, having done absolutely zero sort of investigative actions. I mean, the bad guy is already in custody at that point, and they're just physically taking the paperwork to a federal prosecutor. And it just takes a little bit of an educated eye to look at it. And I try to do that and draw attention to it. But, you know, I want to hone in on, you know, a really good point you made there about the national security space post 9/11, really taking the forefront for the FBI and the problem that that creates. Because on September 10th, our idea of national security was, in the event of any sort of attack, we preserve the Constitution, continuity of government, but we accepted the fact that liberty is inherently dangerous to a certain extent, and we don't do pre-crime in this country. But then after September 11th, when the country was put for a decision, we made the decision that we wanted security over freedom, and therefore no American could ever die at the hands of a terrorist, which necessitates tyranny. And then you have the bureaucracy of the FBI, which gets empowered post 9/11, gets all the tools and the goodies. And the slippery slope begins that all the Ron Paulites and libertarians cautioned about early on there. And the mission set evolved, because in a bureaucracy, success is in growth, not in achieving the mission. The mission itself is just to prop up the bureaucracy further and further. And I've used the analogy of the movie Terminator, because in the movie, Skynet is the computer system. It's artificial intelligence. It's not good. It's not bad. It just is. And it comes to the conclusion that its greatest threat is anyone who will unplug it. So it attacks people in the movie series. And the FBI is the same thing. So post 9/11, the FBI as a bureaucracy was empowered, and it inevitably came to the conclusion that its greatest threat to its mission, to its success, to its growth and getting more personnel and funding and power, were anybody who would stand in the way and want to pare it back or limit those sorts of things. So it evolved the mission set and changed the definition of terrorism from legitimate bad actors with an ideology that they wanted to hurt the country and kill innocent people, to people who were, as the FBI characterized them, anti-government, anti-authority, violent extremists, who the FBI actually defines currently as someone who has a perception of government overreach or negligence. That's it. And then you are defined as a domestic terrorist, ergo they can open up an investigation on you, because all they need is an articulable purpose, no sorts of reasonable allegation of a criminal activity. They just have their man and they can look for the crime.
You know, I remember when they changed that definition before that, I don't know, there's probably been lots of changes, to veterans. They were suspected of now being, you know, ripe for being domestic terrorists. And they had a long list then, too. It was just so offensive. And then, of course, then they expanded it, what, to serious Catholics? I'm not sure what word they used. It's astounding. And none of it's, you know, everybody we're talking to knows about, at least in general, knows that the FBI has just become rotten at the core. It's really sickening, Steve. It's really, really sickening. But here, you know, Kash Patel has said that his goal, one, among other things, that one of his goals is to bend the FBI back to their original mission, fighting crime. So you would agree that that's the right way to go?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look, they have they bragged for years. Director Wray and before him, Comey, were talking about how they had to partner with local agencies. That was really the prime directive. I mean, that was what they claimed it was. It never really was. But that is the answer to the problem we have here. If you actually empower local law enforcement and go to a sheriff or a police chief, a hat in hand, with humbleness, not with hubris, and say, we have capabilities, we have funding, personnel, we just need to know how we can best assist you, sir, in bringing the crime down in your area for your constituents, that would actually get the FBI back to legitimate crime fighting, as opposed to setting fake metrics for themselves to achieve. And when they struggle to do that, let's just look and look for some press releases from local authorities and then claim that we did something.
Yeah. One of the things that I almost pulled this. I saw a video that the acting director before Cash I don't recall his name, but he made a long video standing behind the, you know, what the America's Most Wanted place in the FBI there. I know you know about it. And he's bragging about all the people they've arrested. And then others are saying just exactly what you said. No, the FBI had nothing to do with that. That was ICE. And, you know, the FBI had this minimal role. And he's beating his chest and bragging about this. So it's really happening. That's happening. So Bruce, my husband has said that he thinks one thing that has to happen is that these SACs across the country have to be removed. That you've got to cut off the top because people are loyal to their SACs. For people that don't, that means special agent in charge, and they're the ones that are the head, the big dogs around the country in the various major offices of the FBI. There's a goal to remove and transfer people. Do you have any idea where we are now with firings, removals? Because when they remove some people to a special status, I thought that had been reversed, and I really am unclear. What good things have happened that you know about, Steve?
Well, there were several of these special agents in charge, and for people's edification, there's 55 field offices around the country. There were 56. They just consolidated. Now there's 55. And the SAC, the special agent in charge, is the top dog, with the exception of some of the big offices. They have an assistant director in charge, but, you know, it's just a distinction without difference. And during the confirmation hearings in front of the Senate for Kash Patel, a order came down from the acting deputy attorney general to remove several of these special agents in charge, and I think they took over a dozen of them. But I share your husband's belief here that there just has to be a complete overhaul, and there's a misconception, really, of what it requires to run a field office in the FBI. I mean, there's some that are very large, but others that are quite manageable. I mean, you're talking about an organization, you know, if you were at the helm, it could be a few hundred people. I mean, you know, it might be less than 100 agents, and then you add on top of that support staff, administrative folks. So it's not like you're running the entire military or the entire FBI for that matter. And we're just going to have to demand people who are capable, who have a proven track record, to step into the gap. And step into that breach and leave behind doing the good work that we know that they love to do. We know that they're capable agents of doing, but they have a responsibility to the agency to lead, to set an example, to teach, and to mentor the next generation behind them. And that's going to require guys that maybe been in for a decade and didn't have any ambition of climbing the ladder. And we're not going to require you to relocate and go to Washington, D.C. and uproot anything, but, you know, you live and work in Kansas City, and maybe you need to step out of the gang task force or the bank robbery unit, and you're going to have to take the charge because you've got the subject matter expertise. You've got the contacts with the local law enforcement that the new guy that they have been sending from headquarters doesn't actually have and has required you to be there to liaise between him and the chief. So you could give him a tour and be on his 18-month vacation to your office, and then he just promotes out of it. Well, no, you're going to have to be the guy that does that, and I think that's a different way, again, back to the paradigm shifting, a different way of thinking and looking at people's resumes and saying, well, you don't have any experience in leadership. Well, if you have experience in management or leadership at the FBI at this point, what that to me means is it's a confession that you were part of the problem. So we're going to have to look to other people who possess the skill set that we need to make it a crime-fighting organization rather than a secret police force or a bureaucracy that's just hell-bent on growing.
Well, one of the astounding things that I learned a number of years ago when Bruce and I met was that the FBI's practice of finding people to head these big offices around the country, the 55 offices, is that you sort of volunteer. These promotions are from volunteers. It's not, there isn't enough of the merit. People are not really chosen on merit. And so that's what you talked about, this whole ambitious cycle where people kind of plan their way to the top. And it's just, it's really sick. I think it's got worse under Mueller because it became so corporate. But I think that's a great idea. So now, is the main resistance, you alluded to this earlier, but do you think the main resistance is in D.C.?
I think that there is a tremendous resistance in D.C. for sure. There's also a huge resistance in the New York field office, from my understanding. But that's not the full picture. I mean, I think we have sort of this idea of there's agents that are out in the field that this doesn't really affect them, and they're just trying to do the good work, and that's incomplete. because of the way that, you know, you talk about this management structure, this revolving door of leaders, that they're just constantly going back and forth to headquarters and then coming back out into the field and setting themselves up to promote through their career. Those people are around the country at this point. And then there's also this culture that's been propped by those people who have never said no to a bad idea, who created a construct for themselves to promote within and promote people like them with their quota system, with the integrated program management that's been around for 11 years at this point. And any FBI agent who's been brought up in the last decade plus as part of this, like, that's just it's like the fish doesn't know he's wet. You're just being driven to hit quotas all the time and everything that you do. It's a complete cultural problem at this point. And then the second part of that is the fact that because it can be a rather large agency, depending on where you are, your responsibility can also be compartmentalized really small. And people will delude themselves into participating into things that aren't necessarily in keeping with their oath of office because they can look at their one small carve-out duty and say, well, that's ethical and moral and legal, so I can justify doing it even though the larger mosaic might be something that's completely out of step with our oath of office. We need to be vetting these people and really hammering home that it is incumbent on you to take the step back, look at everything, and say, you know, I know that I'm not putting the Zyklon B into the gas chamber at the end, but putting someone on a cattle car is part of that process. So I need to step up and say no here because I'm part of the overall mission set, and I'm not just going to put my head down and just follow orders, which is what so many people have done for so long.
Yeah, it's true. It's absolutely true. I mean, I know there are a lot of whistleblowers whose names we don't know who've been afraid to come forward, to be as public as you. They're known by some members of Congress because they, you know, whistleblowers have not been treated in the way they should. There's been a huge price, and you've paid it yourself. Yeah, so there, I know that there are a lot of whistleblowers, but not many of them have come forward like you have, Steve. They haven't had the courage, because you didn't get rewarded for coming forward. As far as I can tell, you paid a huge price with your two small children. And so, first of all, we thank you for that kind of example and courage, because it is rare. Hi, this is Sandy Rios. A lot of Christians would be shocked to learn they are personally profiting from abortion and pornography. It's unnerving to realize just how many companies and corporations are actively involved in unbiblical practices. To help cut through the red tape, there is a great option known as Timothy Plan. Timothy Plan is the pioneer in biblically responsible investing. Timothy Plan carefully filters out companies involved in practices Scripture tells us to avoid. We are in an all-out culture war. One powerful way to make a difference is to put our money where our values are. Please go to timothyplan.com/Sandy. That's timothyplan.com/Sandy. Or call 1-800-TIM-PLAN. That's 1-800-846-7526. Discover how to be a biblically responsible investor.
Before investing, carefully consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the investment company. This and other important information can be found in the fund's prospectus. To obtain a copy, visit timothyplan.com or call 800-846-7526. Read each prospectus carefully before investing.
This is Sandy Rios 24/7 on American Family Radio.
As abortion continues to rise, preborn is expanding their life-affirming care in the darkest corners of our nation to help more hurting women and save more babies. If you have the means, would you consider a leadership gift to save babies in a big way? Your tax-deductible donation of $15,000 will place a machine in a needy women's center, saving countless lives for years to come. To donate, go to preborn.com/Sandy. That's preborn.com/Sandy.
The Sandy Rios 24/7 podcast are available at AFR.net. Back to Sandy Rios 24/7 on American Family Radio.
Something I probably wouldn't have done or maybe gotten away with in a more organized investigation, a more organized administration. In the George W. Bush administration, for example, or the Obama administration, the protocol, two men that all of us have perhaps increased appreciation for over the last 2 years. And in both of those administrations, there was process. And so if the FBI wanted to send agents into the White House itself to interview a senior official, you would work through the White House counsel, and there'd be discussions and approvals and who would be there. And I thought, it's early enough, let's just send a couple guys over. And so we placed a call to Flynn, said, hey, we're sending a couple guys over. Hope you'll talk to them. He said, sure. Nobody else was there. They interviewed him in a conference room at the White House Situation Room, and he lied to them. And that's what he's now pled guilty to.
What did he think they were coming over there for?
I don't think he knew. We didn't tell him. Just said, we've got sending over a couple of agents. I want to ask you some questions. I didn't have this conversation. My deputy director did. But hope you got a few minutes. You can sit down and talk to them. And he said, sure.
That's the voice of former FBI Director James Comey in a public setting, laughing about how he set up Lieutenant General Flynn. And he didn't have any idea. Do you know what did he expect you to talk? I don't know that he knew. How did they get in there? He says in an early part of this, I sent them. And then he brags about how that would never have happened in organized White Houses like George W. Bush or Barack Obama. You know the thing that occurs, and then they all laugh. It's so funny. Now, Lieutenant General Flynn, we know enough now about this story to know that none of that is true. Those were twists and turns and lies. And I think we'll get into that in our second discussion with Steve Friend, because we do a part two with him, and we'll get into more of what really was the truth about that. But I wanted to lay the groundwork off to welcome my husband into the discussion, because Bruce, of course, is a former FBI agent, retired, and this is really close to his heart. So he was sitting with me here as I was interviewing Steve. And I want to give Bruce a chance to just really respond. I know you made some notes, Bruce, so I'm just going to turn you loose here. What things really grabbed you about what Steve said?
I think what grabbed me is what James Comey just said as the former director of the FBI, the highest ranking official in the biggest law enforcement agency in the federal government, and how he was preening and proud of basically circumventing a person's due process, as far as I'm concerned.
And setting up a president,
yeah.
His own boss.
Well, it's a big subterfuge on the very first contact they have. And anybody who thinks that this wasn't a setup, just listen to James Comey's own language. He said it's our first contact, and we knew they wouldn't be ready for us. Normally there's a process, but we knew that process wasn't set up yet. So I sent these people in there. What is he worried about? Why can't he go through the White House counsel's office the way they have under Bush and under Obama?
Well, he also, the other tell is he says, I don't know how we got away with it. We got away with it. Did he get away with?
His words were, I wouldn't have done this or gotten away with this normally.
Yeah. Yes.
Think about that. This is the guy who's supposed to be holding everyone accountable in the country to upholding the law, and he's talking about getting away with something.
Bruce, let me just interject, because on behalf of General Flynn, who we know pretty well, now there's a movie about General Flynn, and maybe many of you know the story about this, and I can't tell the whole story in this brief conversation. But let me just say, that was not a lie by General Flynn. That was a setup. They called him when he was out of the country, before he was even in office. He had been the choice, that the election had taken place, but it was before the inauguration. He was out of the country. They called him when he was busy doing something else and asked him questions about some situation. I guess it was his conversation with the Russian foreign minister, which he had every right to do. That's what he had to do. He was the incoming national security director for the president. And so when they came into the White House, they were using the transcript from that conversation where they caught him off guard in a foreign country. I think it was with his family taking a vacation. And then they compared that transcript and found a technical difference in what he said and called it a lie. That's the bottom line, and I think, I'm telling you, I think that Vice President Pence played a huge role in this. because remember that he made a big stink about how Flynn had lied. And it was because he made a big stink that President Trump ended up firing Flynn because he trusted Vice President Pence. That's just a portion of the story.
Well, and you have to remember, Sandy, that this all came as a result of Comey's FBI opening up a case. You know, he admitted in his statement that they had opened a case. And what was that case based on? That was based on the Steele dossier. The Steele dossier was paid for by the Hillary Clinton campaign. And don't tell me the FBI didn't know that, because we've heard agents that looked at the Steele dossier say within a half an hour, we knew it was made up.
Well, Bruce, I have to interject. You know, when you hear talk show hosts say, I told you so, or I said back and thus and such, and I don't like to do that, but I will do this. I saw that when it first came out. I read it, and I said on this mic during the morning show, this can't possibly be true. This is like tabloid ridiculousness. And that's exactly what it was. Yeah. It was all made up.
Because you have to remember, the Steele dossier was a big expose, quote unquote, of all this bad behavior by Donald Trump overseas. Something that would never happen.
Like,
you think Donald Trump is going to go to Europe and urinate on beds and get with prostitutes? I mean, this was outrageous.
Yeah, it was outrageous.
On Comey's part. I mean, it truly is outrageous. And it started this whole Russiagate thing. This affected two, possibly three, presidential election cycles as a story, and may have affected the outcome of one of the elections.
Yes, and then they're still using it. They're invoking it again with the Zelensky, Trump breakdown in the Oval Office. But okay, so that's that Comey exchange. It was just
And you asked me what about Steve's what he had to say impacted me. I thought it was really interesting that he refers to himself now as a recovering FBI agent, and you know, it's kind of funny, but it's also very sad. Because you can listen to Steve and judge for yourself. What I'm judging is that he was probably a very good agent, very intelligent, and cared about the Constitution, which is supposed to be the number one guiding principle of an agent. When you're doing an investigation, you have to do it in a constitutional manner. Now, he really sets it up as upper management of the FBI was putting people, what I would call street agents, they were almost giving them a litmus test. Like, you either participate in these unconstitutional searches and investigations, or we're going to put you on the outside. So it's, are you going to choose the FBI, or are you going to choose your job? And, doing your job by the Constitution. And he chose to object, and you see what they did to him. I mean, they...
It said, you know, I can't believe he doesn't have a job.
No.
How can that be, Bruce? He's in Florida, where people are... there are more conservatives here probably than almost any other state right now. They've all flocked. Even from New York, conservatives have come down. Why can't he find a job with all the gifts that he has?
Well, I think that, we've seen this with other people. We know that once you get, quote-unquote, a black mark against you, it doesn't end there. And let me say, this is not a black mark against Steve Friend. This is actually
a mark of honor.
It's a badge of honor, but it's being portrayed by people as a bad thing. And don't think that if a potential employer gets a hold of the FBI, they don't drop the bomb on him that, well, he was a disruptive force and he wouldn't follow order. He was insubordinate, insubordination here is defined as he followed his conscience and followed the Constitution and refused to do what he was being told by management.
Bruce, we talked about cleaning out the FBI, and I shared with him what you had said, that you felt the SACs, the special agents in charge in these big offices, needed to be replaced. I just wondered if you had any further comments on that.
Well, absolutely, and we've addressed this before, that there's 55 field offices. Each one of them has a special agent in charge, and that's the boss. And each one of these 55 people is hand-selected by the director of the FBI. The director appoints them. So you can imagine when someone is given an office, they are an ally of the director because they only serve usually as the SAC for maybe 2 to 5 years. Five is actually a long time. So it's usually the end of their career or getting towards the end of their career. And you can bet the director is not picking people that are not in alliance or alignment with him. And in this case, we're talking James Comey, we're talking Christopher Wray.
And before that, Robert Mueller, who didn't have his hands clean either.
Right. And it always amazed me when Christopher Wray would testify, he would always act like, gee, I don't really know about that. I mean, I am the boss, but, you know, I'm not down in the details. Listen to me. The SACs in these offices, they're way down in the details. On an investigation like we're talking about, like January 6th, Russiagate, something like that. And don't think that they're not talking with the director on a regular basis as to the status of those investigations. So when Christopher Wray says, I don't really know what was going on there, that is a lie.
Yeah. And I suppose that's the lie before Congress that he was talking about, at least in part, although there are probably other more specifics. Yeah. So let me ask you something, honey, that I did not ask him. The FBI, I don't know how big it is now, but in general, what's the size of the...
It's about 35,000 employees. I think you have about 15,000-ish agents, and the remainder, the 20,000, are some kind of administrative people.
Okay. Well, that's important, a distinction. So 15,000 is not that many. And you heard me ask him, could you not pretty much clean house and start again? Couldn't you do that?
Yeah, and I think you can identify, and Steve did, you can identify some of the major points of resistance right away. I mean, the New York office of the FBI, it's always had a reputation of there's the FBI and then there's the New York office. They do what they want. And I never saw this more clear than what's been going on with this thing with turning over the Epstein files to Pam Bondi, the new attorney general. You have it at headquarters. Listen, the FBI is a very strange organization. The way you get promoted in the FBI is not like a corporation. In a corporation, you have a management trainee program. They identify people early on in their careers that might make good managers, and they start to mentor them. We've talked about this before here. That is not how it is done in the FBI. In the FBI, when there's an opening for a job, a position paper is put out that, hey, this job is open. This is what we're looking for. And then pretty much anyone that meets the minimum requirements, which usually isn't much, is allowed to put in what is called a KSA, knowledge, skills, and abilities. And you tell them what you've done in your career and why you're a good fit. Well, I can tell you, first off, there's a lot of politicking going on there. There's a lot of phone calls made on behalf of people to try to jump them ahead in the line. But also what's really upsetting to me, or was upsetting to me, is that a lot of these KSA statements should have begun with the words, once upon a time. Because when you read them, you don't even believe this is the same person that has written this. It's like, I know this guy. I know he never did these things, or he's pumped it up way beyond what it was. And, you know, there were a lot of jobs that I thought, you know, I'd like to have that job, but I'm just not qualified. And then the job would finish posting, someone would be selected, and I would just shake my head and go, you know, I may not have been qualified, but I'm sure a lot more qualified than the person they took. So that's a big problem, Sandy, is right away we have people doing things that they're not qualified to do. And the other thing is the musical chairs that you play in the FBI in order to go through your career. If you are going to become an SAC, that means you've probably taken a minimum 3 or 4 transfers, but they're always quick. Therefore, say like 18 months, you go somewhere, you learn a job, you quote unquote learn a job, and then you're qualified to go to the next step of the management ring. Then you go there, and you do something for 18 months. Well, I don't know about you, but, you know, you're moving your family, so the first 3 months or so, you're in disarray. You're trying to get your family settled. You're trying to find a place to live, grocery store, where to go to church, whatever you're looking for. Then you spend the next year learning the job, and probably after about a year, you know it pretty well. But then these people are concerned about their next transfer. So what they're doing is they're not worrying about the job so much as they're worrying about, where can I fit on the organizational chart? So they're checking for the open jobs and what's going to become open. And my point is, this is no way to run a railroad. It's all about somebody getting ahead in their career instead of enforcing the law, maintaining liaison with the local people, getting to know your own personnel, getting to know the cases. You might, out of that 18 months, you might say half of it be involved in the actual cases, but the rest is you're doing other things.
Bruce, it's been a while since we only have a few more minutes for this first conversation. We'll talk more on this after the second conversation with him. But I want to remind you, you told me, you went to the FBI building when you were a little boy with your parents, and you went to the shooting gallery, and the FBI agent was representing all this stuff, and you said to your parents, that's what I want to do. And you actually grew up and ended up going to law school just so that you could go to the FBI. And for you, it was a calling.
Yes, it was.
Yeah. Would you say that at the time that you went through, that you picked that up from the other, not without exception, but for the most part, the guys were going in because they felt called to serve in that way?
Well, certainly. We started usually with a class of about 50, and of the 50 I went in with, many, many of them had a call. I wouldn't say all, but, you know, some just like the idea of, hey, I'd like to try to be an FBI agent. And you could tell who had it and who didn't. And I don't mean that derogatorily, but I'm just saying there were certain people we were like gung ho, ready to go. And
you're on a mission, to be the good guys. It reminds me of what Elon Musk said recently. That I think I've said this on the mic. I'm sure I have. He said on the stage when we were in D.C. at CPAC recently. He said he grew up watching American movies and shows, and he noticed that America was unique in the world, that it believed in good and evil, and they had good guys who always beat the bad guys. And he said, I wanted to be a good guy. And I think that's true. We grew up watching The Rifleman. We grew up watching, there was a narrative that's really a beautiful one, that right would prevail, and it usually did up until about the 70s.
Yeah, I was so impressed when I went through the FBI building. Back then, there was no Quantico, and so everything was contained within that big building on 9th Street in Pennsylvania in Washington, D.C., and I just walked through, and I was looking at the top 10 fugitive board and thinking, wow, man, look at these guys. They're wanted. You know, we can go try to get them. And then the lab, the way they were doing fingerprinting and comparing like chisel marks and things, like say from a burglary of a home. And then, as you stated, the piece de resistance was when we got to the end and they took us in this theater and opened up the curtain, and there was an agent. And he just did all kinds of things with firearm shooting and machine gun. You know, I'm from Chicago, and I remember when I went through the training academy, and one day they'd have Rambo Day where we'd try out all the weapons, and we no longer use the Thompson machine gun, the famous machine gun, but they brought it out for that day. And when you walked up, they'd say, tell us your name and where you're from. And I said, Bruce Rather from Chicago. And the guy said, gee, this ought to be genetic to you, the Thompson machine gun from the gangster days in Chicago.
Well, you know, and I want to add that, and we can't go on with more stories that I'd like to, but because I know my husband, he's Mr. Mild-mannered, but I'm telling you that the agents of that time got in some really dangerous situations. Some of them were killed. They had to fight. They had to take on things. They're not like police do the same thing, but different. The FBI doesn't have maybe as many violent encounters percentage-wise, but they do get in very dangerous situations, and they have to be prepared and ready to do whatever it is they have to do. And I know that you did that, Bruce. So I thank you for your service. But I wanted to paint a picture of what the FBI was like when you aspired to being that and when you were serving. Well, that was a great discussion with Steve Friend. I think you would agree. We're going to have part two with him. We're going to get into whether Comey and Ray should be prosecuted. We're going to get into that whole business of the Epstein files, the Southern District of New York office, all of that in our next discussion with Steve Friend. Before we say goodbye, I want to thank Timothy Plan because they sponsor the show and they make it possible for us to talk. They teach you how to put your money where your values are and discover how to be a biblically responsible investor. Visit timothyplan.com/Sandy. That's timothyplan.com/Sandy. Or call 1-800-TIM-PLAN. That's 1-800-TIM-PLAN. Well, thank you for listening. And, honey, thank you for joining me. People have missed you, you know.
I have missed them. And this was a great show to come back on. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, honey. And so I want to thank the rest of you for listening to today's edition of Sandy Rios 24/7.